Our third interview is about the early diagnosis and prompt referral of childhood brain tumours. In the UK, about 400 to 500 children every year are diagnosed with brain tumours. However, evidence suggests that the time to diagnosis is longer in the UK than in other parts of Europe and the US. The Head Smart campaign was established by a collective of healthcare academics, professionals and charities with the aim of reducing the time to diagnosis of child brain tumours. In this interview, David Cartwright talks to Professor David Walker, a paediatric oncologist at the University of Nottingham and clinical lead of the Head Smart campaign, about the role optometrists can play in identifying these children.
David, why do you feel it takes longer in the UK to diagnose children's brain tumours?
I'm going to be a bit defensive because our research ranked the interval between different countries and the UK is bottom of the ranking. However, statistically, the data was not good enough to truly rank it. So I'll say that as a qualifying statement. We aren't at the top, and we are a first world country with an outstanding health system. I think one of the main reasons why there is a difference in the symptom interval in the UK compared to Europe is that children see general practitioners in the UK who see people from birth through to old age. Whereas in mainland Europe, children mainly see paediatricians who only see children and young people. And so their expertise is concentrated in the age group. If you were to ask me why there is a difference, I'd say that's the most likely difference. In the US, if we compare ourselves to the US, they have a health system that has rapid access to all types of diagnostic facilities. And they don't have the same control of referral because people go to their specialist early because that's what they have. And so it's a commercially driven system. And scans are done routinely in many, many situations. In the UK, we tend to ration our scans a bit to ones we think we really need them. And that's not a bad thing. However, in these circumstances, perhaps a little bit less rationing would help us.
So a key to early diagnosis, perhaps, is speciality in the particular subject area.
Yeah, the trouble is when you have the symptoms, you don't know what the diagnosis is. And so therefore, directing somebody to a specialist means you need to know the diagnosis before you redirect them. So that is the difficulty. I think the optometrists are part of the specialist network for children. And their ability to refer to the health professions directly, whether it be the GP or the hospital, is particularly valuable quality to the service that they offer.
What is the consequence of that not diagnosing children's brain tumours as quickly as would be ideal?
There are two categories of brain tumour. Those that are aggressive and grow fast, and they tend to have a short symptom interval. For them, the consequences of delay in diagnosis are severe because they've got a severe problem, but speeding up the diagnosis may not have much impact. There are other categories, which are about half the patients, who have a slow-growing tumour, and the consequences for delays for them may be quite significant because the longer the tumour grows slowly, the more brain damage it causes. And the more brain damage they have before we start treatment, the more there will be at the end of treatment. And so, therefore, the delay for the slower-growing tumours is probably more severe than the ones for the fast-growing tumours.
So, simply, more children may die or be left with lasting long-term behavioural or physical problems.
There are two risks of delay in diagnosis. One is there are a small but significant number of children who present with such severe symptoms that they can die before any diagnosis is made. And this has been happening in all countries. I've seen reports in all countries of events like this. So earlier diagnosis, hopefully, would screen those people out and they would be diagnosed before they had a life-threatening complication. The other group of people are people who arrive in the hospital having had symptoms for months or years who may be blind, disabled, or damaged in their cognitive capacity. And there is some evidence that that does occur.
Is there a difference between the development of brain tumours in children compared to adults?
Yeah, there is, because children are growing up and adults are getting old. My daughter tells me that I'm getting old and she's growing up, and your brain drives the way you grow up. and it does so at different stages in your life. So the first 5 years of your life, your brain is growing massively, and the way you have symptoms then are different, because A, you don't have much language under the age of three, so you can't describe your symptoms. Secondly, the skull is flexible, and so you don't tend to get headaches in the same way, because the skull can flex if there's raised pressure. And thirdly, the brain is in that early stage of development where it doesn't work the same way as it does an older person. You only have to look at a baby who lies on their back and maybe only smiles at you, whereas a two-year-old child comes up and talks with you. So you're dealing with a differently developed system. So the symptoms present differently because of that reason. Between the ages of 5 and 12, which is the main school age, the children, of course, are very articulate. And they often present with symptoms. They describe the headaches or the vomiting or disturbance in their school capacity. And so teachers may say, your son or your daughter isn't behaving the same way in school as he was before. And that may be because they're being naughty, or it may be because their brain isn't working very well and the teachers notice the difference.
So what are the common presenting signs and symptoms of a typical child, if there is a typical child with a brain tumour?
Right, I'm going to answer that in three categories. The under five-year-olds, so that's the preschool child, often present, particularly in the first 2 years of life, with their head getting a bit bigger and them being lethargic and disinterested and maybe not very good vision. And sometimes they have funny eye movements which haven't been noticed before. And they need to be differentiated from straightforward amblyopia, which is quite common, and you know lots about that. But we need to know that this is definitely amblyopia, or is it a paralytic squint, or do they have nystagmus of an unusual nature? Because in the under 1 and 2 year olds, they often have vertical nystagmus or rotatory nystagmus, or nystagmus not typical of a cerebellar problem, for instance. So under 5, they present in that way. In the school-age children, in 5 and 12, they often present with headaches and vomiting, school behaviour, and something else, often a weakness or a poor balance or poor coordination. And so the cluster of symptoms makes people alert. The teenagers present slightly differently. They can get headaches and vomiting and visual problems, but also they can have disturbances of the way their puberty is progressing. Because the brain drives puberty, and in adolescence, puberty is the process that you're going through. So they can either have early puberty or late puberty or non-progressive puberty. And that's quite hard to pick up because that takes weeks or months to happen. And it takes a good clinician to realise that that's part of the symptoms and not just a natural process.
Is it possible to summarise, thinking particularly about an eye examination, what an optometrist specifically would be looking for, thinking about children's brain tumours during an eye examination?
Yeah. In the under five-year-old, I've talked about the differentiation of amblyopia from a paralytic squint and then looking for abnormal eye movements. Those are three challenging. And many doctors find that quite difficult. They're not truly experts. General practitioners know about amblyopia. They know about paralytic squint and they know about funny eye movements. But assessing them in a preschool-aged child is challenging at the best of times because their cooperation and the frequency with which you do these assessments as a general practitioner is low. So optometrists would have expertise in that, and I think that's one of the big areas that optometrists can really help in, is understanding the difference in amblyopia, a paralytic squint, and then the abnormal eye movements, and saying this is what we're seeing. The other thing is looking at the back of the eye. In an under five-year-old, that is difficult for anybody, and sometimes you're lucky and you get a clear view, and sometimes it's difficult. And in the hospital, if we really want to look at the back of the eye and we can't get it with cooperation, we have the luxury of being able to put them to sleep or sedate them in order to do it. And I think that sometimes is necessary with any child. So being able to look at the back of the eye and see the state of the retina, and particularly look at the optic disc and see if there's papilledema, can be very important. And I think for most primary care physicians, general practitioners, that is an infrequent event for them. And so you can't rely upon them being able to do that because of the difficulties. In school-aged children, those tests are all much more doable because they're used to being given instructions and cooperating, and they can reason and be understood. And so generally, the examination of the eye is easier in a school-aged child. And I think a general practitioner can be expected to be able to do that
reasonably well because eye examination is a normal part of neurology and we all should be able to do a bit of that. The hardest thing about diagnosing adolescents is getting them to come to your clinic at all because they feel quite scared by the environment. And how you create an environment for an adolescent is different to the way you create an environment for an adult or a child, because an adolescent may come on their own without their parents.
And I get the impression from what you said that the combination of the various signs and symptoms is particularly important.
Yes, I mean, if you rank them, the commonest ones are headaches, but that only affects 50%. So there's 50% of people who present with brain tumours without headaches. The next ones are normally vomiting, but it's new vomiting, something you weren't doing a few months ago or a few weeks ago. And so you have to decide, is this vomiting due to an intercurrent infection or some other cause? And there are lots of causes for that. And then the third one often is an abnormality of the eye or an abnormality of movement. And one, if you've got three or four of those, then you start to say, well, this is really something else other than just a straightforward headache or straightforward vomiting. This is putting the three or four things together, which should give people the clue. We would like people to think it a bit earlier, actually. The sooner we think about it, you know, for in our view, the risks of delayed diagnosis can be reduced.
If an optometrist is suspicious then, what would be your advice on their next steps? And particularly, would you have any advice on the urgency? So how quickly should the child then be examined?
Urgency depends on how well the child is. If the child's got signs of raising intracranial pressure and you may think it's very, then they should go to the hospital that day and a scan needs to be done within 24 hours. Because if it is at that stage, then minutes do matter. If, however, the patient is not obviously ill, but you are suspicious, then a rapid referral within a fortnight. And normally, if you say to a family, we think there may be something wrong in their head, they pressurise you to do it that day because they want to know the answer. But clinically, one could argue that as long as it's rapid, that you've made the contact with the hospital that day and they made arrangements, then you've done your duty. Normally that should happen within a week, I would suspect, often within 24 or 48 hours. If you ring a GP up or a paediatrician up and say, I think this child's got raised pressure, my experience is they say, come and see me now.
Have you had any experience of examples where an urgent or a rapid optometric referral has made a significant difference to the outcome for the child?
Yeah, actually, it's not at all uncommon that the optician visit with an optometrist measurement is the precipitating cause for referral. Because often the general practitioner will say, go and have your eyes tested. And in the process of having your eyes tested, somebody does this detailed formal examination of vision and discover the abnormality. And there are some great stories of people going backwards and forwards to the doctor saying, and not getting anywhere, that when somebody sends them to the optician or they choose to go to the optician to get their eyes tested, that is the trigger that gets the diagnosis made, and they often talk about it very positively. The Jimmy Teen's TV website has got a brain tumour debate under the heading of Headspace, where somebody tells that very story, and the optometrist is there in the debate and receives the accolade for having made the diagnosis when many other people had not.
Thank you, David and David.